Okay, we're in the middle of discussing the end of the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Anshei Knesset HaGdola said three things. Having Mesunim Badin, a person should be deliberate, patient when he judges. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe, have a lot of students. And Asus Yog LaTorah. The Reb Chaim Volozhiner says that these three things correspond to three different aspects of a person. A person's soul, or his nefesh, and his ruach, and his neshama. His life force, and speech, and the spiritual side of a person. How so? The actions of a person, the nefesh is more the physical life force of the person. That's in action, a person should make a fence around the Torah. That takes care of the part of a human being of action. And then in the ruach has to do with speech. And speech is hamidu talmidim harbe, teach a lot of students. That has to do with speech. And the neshama has to do with thought. And thought is mesunim badin, is being deliberate and patient when you judge. This idea of mesunim badin, of being patient and not judging quickly, does not only apply to judges, but it applies to every person, and we explained a few weeks ago in great detail the importance of thinking, of deliberating, of not doing things flippantly and without thought. So every person has to be deliberate and think through things and not do things without thinking. So that's mesunim badin. Part of the mesunim badin is when you judge people to be patient before you come to a conclusion and judge them harshly, but give them the benefit of the doubt. And look for every way of seeing the merit of the person and the giving them the benefit of the doubt rather than jumping to a conclusion of judging them harshly. And that fits together with having a lot of students. If you judge people favorably, people will flock to you, and you'll have a lot of students. And if you judge everybody harshly, you're not going to have too many people following you, and you won't have a lot of students either. Another idea, the Baal Shem Tov says an interesting idea of why it's important when you judge others to judge them with great patience. He says that sometimes somebody does something wrong and you don't see it. When you do something wrong, kol mumim adam roeh chutz mimumei atzmo. Person sees everybody's blemishes except his own. And you make all kinds of excuses for yourself, but you don't do that for other people. So sometimes a person does something wrong and he doesn't realize it. Because when it comes to himself, sees things in a very distorted way. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings that same thing to him that somebody else does, and that he's going then to have to judge that other person in his mind. And as he judges that other person, he's judging himself. And the Rabban Hashem says, the way that you judge that other person who did what you did, but you can't see it on yourself, that's how I will judge you. So therefore, a person should be very deliberate when he judges other people, realizing that he may be judging himself. The classic example of that is when David HaMelech sinned with Bathsheba, and Nosson HaNavi came to him and gave him a whole story of a man who had had only one little goat, one little sheep, and another rich man came and took it from him. And David HaMelech said that person should be killed for what he did. And Nosson said, that's you. That's exactly what you did. I just gave you a story, but looking at the story from afar, right, David HaMelech was able to see it a lot more clearer than looking at himself. Okay. Another idea of Hevi Mesunim Badin, the Gemara says that we learn this from the fact of Losalu B'malos Al Mizbechi, in the end of Seder Yisrael, right after the Torah was given. The Torah says that you should build an altar and that you shouldn't ascend the altar on steps. Losalu B'malos Al Mizbechi, there was a ramp that went up the altar, but you couldn't ascend the altar on steps. One of the reasons is that you shouldn't take larger steps, and they used to wear robes or whatever, and it would be immodest to walk like that. So you walk on the ramp, and they walked heel to toe, where they didn't separate their legs, so it was more modest walking. It's one reason. And we learn from there that if being immodest over stones is not proper, most certainly being immodest in the presence of people is surely not proper. But the Gemara says another reason why, and right after that it says the Eila Hamishpatim Asher Tosim Lefnehem. It speaks about judges and judging civil cases and court cases or whatever. So the Gemara says one of the reasons you're not allowed to go up steps by the altar is that you should be able to deliberate and walk slowly. On a ramp, you have to walk slower than you can run a flight of steps. But it's more than just being slow. It's a different aspect completely of what it means to be patient and deliberate when you judge. When you climb steps, you climb one step at a time. And all you see is what's right in front of you. When you climb a ramp, it is a succession. There's no separation. It's all one connected movement. That's what it means to be deliberate. People sometimes only see a portion of the picture. And when you see a portion of the picture, you see it distorted. You have to be able to be patient until you can see the whole picture before you come to a conclusion. That's what it means. Don't climb the Mizbeach on steps, and that is also a directive to judges. Don't deliberate things like you're climbing steps, one thing at a time, seeing things unconnected. But wait, like on a ramp, and you see the connection between all those steps, and then you'll be able to make a clear deliberation. Because when you see things piecemeal and fragmented, then you tend to see them in a very distorted way. And that's why this week's Sedra, let's connect it to the Sedra, Moshe Rabbeinu asked the Rabbanu Shalom the age-old question of Hodieni da es drachecha, let me know your ways. And the Gemara says he meant Loma yesh tzadik v'tovlo, tzadik v'ralo. Why are there tzadikim who have it good and tzadikim who have it bad in this world? Rasha v'tovlo, rasha v'ralo. Why are there wicked people who have it good and wicked people who have it bad? Let's first understand the question. Because if we would have asked the question, we wouldn't have asked so many questions. It does not bother me why there are tzadikim who have it good. Nor does it bother me why there are rishayim who have it bad. What bothers me is tzaddikim who have it bad and rishayim that prosper. So Moshe Rabbeinu should have asked two questions. Explain to me why there are tzaddikim who suffer and rishayim that prosper. Why did he also ask, I want to know why there are tzaddikim who prosper and rishayim who suffer. Why did he ask all four? So I think the real answer is, I'm going to give you another answer in a second. I think the simplest real answer is the following. If we would see that every righteous person suffers in this world and every wicked person prospers, then we'd have to redefine our perspective of what this world is all about. We have to come to the conclusion that for some reason this world was made for tzaddikim to suffer and rishayim to prosper, because that's the way it is all the time. But once you see there are tzaddikim who prosper, and there are rishayim who suffer, now it's a question. Then why are there tzaddikim who suffer? And why are there rishayim who prosper? If it can be the other way, then why isn't it by everybody? So the question is only predicated on the fact that there are tzaddikim that prosper. Then why are there tzaddikim that suffer? But if every tzaddik would suffer, we just have to come to the conclusion that's the purpose of the world. For some reason, we'd have to explain it like that. Okay, in any case. But the deeper explanation, I think, is the following. The Tosafot Rosh Hashiva explains the pasuk that we say every Shabbos, at least. Ishbar lo yeda uchesil lo yavin ezos. An ignorant person doesn't know, and a fool doesn't know this. And he says the following. There's no sin in being ignorant. There's no embarrassment in being ignorant. We are all ignorant of many things. Being a fool, however, is an embarrassment. What's an ignorant person? An ignorant person who says, I don't know. All don't know a lot of things. I don't know. Ish bar lo yedach. An ignorant person doesn't know. But aksil, what is aksil? Aksil can be illustrated in the following way. Imagine a United States senator who is the head of the Appropriations Committee for NASA Space Control. He has to okay every expenditure that NASA makes. And if he doesn't okay it, then they don't get funding for it. And this person knows very little about electronics. He knows with difficulty how to turn on his transistor radio. Beyond that, he doesn't know too much. He walks into NASA Space Control with all this sophisticated electronic gadgetry, and he doesn't want people to think he's ignorant. So he walks over to one console, one machine, and he says, I don't understand why you need this machine here, and until it's explained to me, I'm not funding that machine. That's a fool. Everything else in the room, every other gadget you understand, 100%. Just that one not? That's a fool. Kshil lo yovin is zos. A fool doesn't know this. When he doesn't understand anything. That's a fool. A fool is a person who says, well, I can't believe in God because of the Holocaust. Because until I understand the Holocaust, I can't believe in God. Right? And everything else in the world you do understand. Why children are born healthy and why the world... that everything you understand. The one thing in the world you don't understand is the Holocaust. So until that is explained to you, right, you can't believe in God. And everything else you do understand, that's a fool. A fool is somebody who points at this and says, this I don't understand, when he doesn't understand anything. I have yet to have somebody come to me after davening in the morning, upset, and say, Rabbi, I must speak to you. I woke up this morning, I'm healthy, my wife is healthy, my children are healthy, Baruch Hashem making a living, I don't know why God is doing this to me. No one ever asked me that question. Never. Yet, the other way, I've had many people ask the question. I'm not well, my children aren't well, my wife's not well, I'm not making a living. Why is God doing this to me? The first way, we do understand. The second way, not know. The answer is we don't understand anything. Right? But we seem to trust God when he's doing what we like. When it's not what we like, then already we have questions. But it's not because we understand the other way either. Right? It's just that we don't ask questions because why question God? If he wants to do good for me, obviously he knows what he's doing. So, that was Moshe's question. I'm not a fool, said Moshe Rabbeinu. I'm not just going to ask on the things that bother me. Why do righteous people suffer and why are there wicked people who prosper? But I want to know everything. Why are there righteous people who prosper and why are there wicked people who suffer? Just to say I understand that 100%, I understand it either. So explain everything to me. As much as I can understand, I'd like to understand. But I'm not just going to pick out the things that bother me, said Moshe Rabbeinu, and ask on them. I want to ask in general. All everything, all the aspects. So what was God's answer to Moshe Rabbeinu? His answer was, according to the Chasam Sofer, V'ra'isa es achorai uponai lo yiro. You will see me from behind, but you will not see my face. Says the Chasam Sofer, what that means is the following. In retrospect, when you see the whole picture, you'll understand it. But in hindsight, but in foresight, before, as it's happening, you can't understand it. Meaning the following. if you don't see, and this is what it has to do with what we said, if you don't see the whole picture, if you're not climbing that ramp and you put everything together, then you're going to get a distorted picture of everything. If you only see things piecemeal. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich gives the following marshal to seeing things piecemeal, where if you would see the whole picture, you would see it differently. It says, Ein Tzur Kelokeinu, Chana, in her tefillah, after she had Shmuel, she said, there is no rock like God. Ein Tzur Kelokeinu. So the Gemara says, Al Tikre Tzur Elet Sayar, there is no artist like God. And the Gemara gives an explanation of why God is the ultimate artist. Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Torah Vadas in America about 80 years ago, and he was also the founder of Torah Mesorah and the father of most of the day schools, if not all the day schools in America, all over America. So he said the following. Once the Gemara compares God to an artist, we can take that comparison further and say the following. If you take a kindergarten child and you tell him to draw the picture of a person in front of him, so what does he do? He draws a circle, that's the head. He draws a line down, that's the body. Two lines out, arms. Two lines down, legs. Two dots for eyes, dot for a nose, big smile, and he's finished. And you know exactly what he's drawing every step along the way. If you tell Rembrandt to paint the same picture, he doesn't start with a big circle. He dabs a little red paint here and a little black paint over there. Somebody who knows nothing about art will go over to Rembrandt and say, Mr. Rembrandt, you just ruined this canvas. What's this, red paint, black paint? I'll give you another canvas, start with the circle, and let's get this finished. You know what Rembrandt will say? The painting's going to take me 6 months. Have a seat, be patient, don't ask me any questions. If when you see the entire picture you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. What's going to be when he sees the entire picture? He's going to see that the red was needed for contrast, and the black was needed to make a shadow, and everything fits perfectly into the picture. But as you see it being created piecemeal, you don't see its true meaning. If you don't see the whole picture, you can see things distorted. If you're missing facts, missing details, then things can be totally distorted. Another example, give you two more examples maybe. You walk into the following scene. A masked man is holding a knife over someone ready to cut off his leg. So you say, wow, there's a terrorist attack going on. This masked man is a mechabel, and he's going to wreak terrible injustice to this poor victim. So you decide you're going to be a hero. You knock out the masked man, and you drag the victim to safety. And he looks up at you and he says, why did you do that? Right? My doctor said that I had gangrene and I needed to have my leg amputated immediately or I was going to die. Why did you burst into the operating room, knock out my doctor, and drag me out? Now I'm going to die. You thought that you saved this person's life because he was undergoing some kind of terrible thing, when in fact what he was undergoing was a very, very therapeutic and very positive thing. The masked man was not a terrorist. He was a doctor. But you didn't see the whole picture. Another example they give. A city slicker comes to the farm for the first time in his life, and he sees a farmer carrying what he thinks is cereal in his hands. So he says, oh, these farmers are really primitive, right? We put cereal in boxes and they eat it like a mensch. This guy carries his cereal in his hands, but I guess he's going to eat breakfast. So he follows the farmer, and he takes the cereal, and he throws it into the mud. And then he covers it over with mud, goes over to him, he says, look, you know, I hate to say this, but in the city, we eat that cereal. It's very nourishing and very good. Right? Why are you throwing it in the mud? He says, see, you've never been on a farm. He says, why don't you come back and meet me in this place in 6 months? 6 months later, they come back, and he sees where the farmer threw the cereal into the mud, that there's growing more cereal, 100 times more cereal in that same place. He says, hey, the farmer's not so stupid, right? He obviously knew that if he planted the cereal, it would grow into more cereal. So He figures now the guy's going to have a really big breakfast. So he starts taking knives and cutting down the cereal. He says, what did the cereal do to you? You have to attack it with knives? He says, okay, but he figures, okay, now he's gonna eat it. He takes it and he starts beating the grain. He says, what did the grain do to you? You have to beat it. No, beats it. He figures, okay, he likes to eat powder. Maybe his teeth aren't that good. He can't eat this grain. He'll eat a powder. He takes the powder, starts mixing it with water. He says, okay, maybe he likes paste. Puts the paste in a fire. Now he's burning it. Right? This guy's crazy. Right? What does he have against this grain? He beats it, he burns it, cuts it. Finally, he sees the bread. Until you see the whole process, every step along the way can be distorted, and you can see things in a very, very distorted way. It's only when you're able to see the entire picture that you can see things properly. Another story of Yonasan Apeshit says, it says that when they were combing the flesh of Rabbi Akiva with iron combs, so the angels came and complained and said to God, Zu Torah v'zu Schara, this is the reward that Rabbi Akiva gets for his tremendous Torah, to have his flesh combed with iron combs. This is what a tzaddik is supposed to get. This is fair. This is just. God told them, Stoke, you keep quiet, or I will turn the world back to tohu vavohu. If you don't keep quiet, mind your business, don't ask any questions. If you don't keep quiet, I will turn the world back to its original state of tohu vavohu. So most people think that God was threatening the angels. You better not ask any questions on me, because otherwise I will make the whole world null and void, and you'll cease to exist, and therefore keep quiet. Says Rabbi Yonasan Apeshitz, God was saying something else completely different. And he gives the following marshal. He said there was once a exquisite Jewish tailor who was the most talented tailor in the kingdom. And the king wanted to have made the most exquisite robe that ever was made in history. And he realized the only one who could make this robe is this Jewish tailor. So he brought him gold and silver and precious gems and the greatest, materials. And he told him, here, I want you to take all these materials and I want you to make me the most exquisite robe that ever was made. So the tailor took all these materials and Hitaka made from the jewels and from the gold and the silver and the materials the most exquisite robe that ever was made, and the king treated him royally. Now, made him his official royal tailor, right, and made him a rich man. The anti-Semites, the Goyim in the king's entourage, were jealous of this Jewish tailor, and it killed them that this Jew was getting such covet. So they went to the king, and they said to him, you think that this tailor used all the materials that you gave him to make that rope? He pilfered a good portion of it for himself. And he didn't put all of them into your rope. So he became a rich man on your cheshbon, stealing from you a lot of the raw materials that you gave him. The king goes to the tailor, and he says, you know, people are saying about you that you didn't put all the raw materials I gave you into the rope, and that you took some for yourself. I find that hard to believe, but can you prove to me, so I have what to say to these anti-Semites who are jealous of you, that I can answer them? The tailor says, sure, give me the rope. Gives him back the rope, and he starts to take it apart. He says, what are you doing? He says, well, the only way I can prove to you that every single thing you gave me is in this robe is if I take it apart completely, and I will lay out in front of you all the raw materials, and you'll see. You can weigh them, you can count them, and you'll see that everything you gave me is in the robe. But otherwise, there's no way in the world that I can prove to you that everything you gave me is in the robe. The only way I can do it is take it apart. So too said God to the angels. Right? When I created the world, I created it with a plan. Everything fits that plan, and if you see the whole picture, even the combing of Rabbi Akiva's flesh in this world is for his neshama's betterment eternally. There's more than you can see. There's more than just this world. There's eternity. Now, when I created the world, I put in everything that's necessary till eternity, and this is part of it. Now, if you have complaints and you don't think that this is part of the plan, then I have only one Eitzah. Take everything apart, lay it out again, and that let you see what the thing was. So I'll turn the world back into the way it started. You can now look at all the components and see if that's part of the plan. But there's no way for me to explain it to you now if you don't see everything in front of you. You're either going to have to wait until the culmination of the picture, or I will take everything apart and show you the raw materials. That's the idea. The Chafetz Chaim says this in a very cute way. How, if you don't see the whole picture, you can distort things. There's a pasuk that we say every day, three times a day. Shomer Hashem Eskol Ohavav, God guards and protects all those that he loves, the Eskol HaRishoyim Yashmid, and he destroys all the wicked. Okay, one of these tape recorders went off. Yeah, this one. Okay, that's supposed to happen. In any case, if it's a hint, I can't take a hint. So, there's nothing wrong with that pasuk. Sounds very nice. God protects and guards the ones he loves and destroys the wicked. What happens if you never heard that pasuk and you walked into shul one day late and they were saying with great kavana the following, Eskol Ohavav v'Eskol HaRishoyim Yashmid, all those that he loves and all the Rishoyim God's going to destroy. And you say, hey, that's not fair. Why would God want to destroy all the people he loves? And you walk out of shul perplexed. Or, you never heard that pasuk, you came to shul and you left early. And what did you hear? Shomer Hashem Eskol Ohavav v'Eskol HaRishoyim. God will protect all those that he loves and all the Rishoyim. Hey, that's not fair. Why would God want to protect all the Rishoyim? Says the Chafetz Chaim, we come late to this world and we leave early. So we have a lot of questions. But if we came on time and we left on time and we saw the whole picture from beginning to end, there wouldn't be any questions. Everything would be very clear. I'll give you an example from life. Many years ago, I think it was in the 1970s, there was a terrible airline crash in Chicago. It was the worst air disaster in the United States up till that point. A jet took off, full, about 300 people on it, and it nosedived. Within a minute and a half of takeoff, a engine fell off the wing, and everybody was killed. And there were articles in the paper. I lived in Miami at the time. I remember in the Miami Herald, they had about people who were on the plane, obituaries of people who were on the plane, people who were supposed to be on the plane and didn't get on the plane, people who, whatever. There was one story there that caught my attention and fits this idea. There was a woman who had a family reunion that she wanted to get to. And she didn't have a reservation on the plane. She was on standby. And if she missed this plane, she missed the family reunion. And she really wanted to get on the plane. So she kept badgering the people at the gate, can I get on? Is there a seat? And they told her, lady, we have to wait for about 10 minutes before we close the doors. We'll count and see who's here. And if people don't show up, you are the first person to get on the plane. You're the first person on the standby list. But we can't tell you until 10 minutes before we close the doors. So have a seat and be patient. And she didn't. Every 2 minutes she got up. Can I get on? Can I have a seat? There was a man there who was going on a business trip. He had a reservation. He had a seat on the plane. And he was going to a business meeting, which basically was for his sake. In other words, the business meeting was not for his sake. It was he was coming to that meeting for the sake of the people who were making the meeting. So if he didn't make it, they would postpone the meeting. They couldn't have the meeting without him. So he said, look, I see this lady really wants to get on the plane. And if I don't get on the plane, so they'll reschedule the meeting. It'll be a little inconvenience, but nishkeferlich. If she doesn't get on the plane, she's going to miss her family reunion. I can see it really makes a difference to her. So he decided to do her a favor. And he went over, he said, look, I'll give you my seat on the plane, and I'll take your standby number. If I get on, Very nice. If I don't get on, so they'll reschedule my business meeting. She was so thankful. She said this is her lucky day. And he felt that he was really doing a favor to somebody else and inconveniencing himself. How long did it take before it was obvious that this was not this lady's lucky day? She didn't have the reunion with the family she thought she was going to have, but with other members of her family who were no longer here. So, and this man didn't do a favor to somebody else. He saved his own life. How long did it take to be able to see that what appeared one way, if you just wait a few minutes, appears completely different the other way? How long did it take? 10 minutes? 15 minutes? 20 minutes? So unless you see the whole picture, and we don't see the whole picture because we can't see the future, we can't see the past, we can't see all the other worlds, all we see is a little thing we see in front of us. That's what it means. If you want to deliberate and you want to see things properly, don't do it step by step, but do it like a ramp. You have to see the entire connection of situations, and then you can make a decision. And that's what the Rabban Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu. V'ra'isa achorai. If you want to understand why there are tzaddikim who suffer and why there are wicked people who prosper, in the end, when you'll see the whole picture and you'll look back, in hindsight, you'll be able to understand everything. But upanai, looking ahead, you can't understand it. Because you only see it piecemeal, you won't be able to understand it. The Rav Shamshon Feuerherz says the answer to Moshe Rabbeinu was in a different part of the pasuk. The pasuk says, "Hinei makom iti." There's a place here by me. So Rav Shamshon Feuerherz, before I tell you what he says, I'll tell you a story, and then it makes what Rav Shamshon Feuerherz says more understandable. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels was the Rav of Weizen in Poland before World War II. He was taken to Auschwitz, and he spent time in Auschwitz. He was later, after the war, he came to America, and he lived in Chicago, Weizenerov. So, and he created a kehillah there in Chicago, yeshiva and a kehillah, whatever. In any case, he wrote a sefer called Mekadshei Hashem. It was a collection of Torah from Talmidei Chachamim who were killed during the Holocaust. But to that sefer, he wrote an introduction. And in the introduction, he writes a lot of stories that happened to him while he was in Auschwitz. He said that one of the things that happened to him was the following. One day, a SS soldier comes to him and says, "Rabbiner, the commandant of the camp wants to see you immediately." And it was known that this commandant was a sadist and that he enjoyed killing people just like this, torturing them, whatever. And when people were called to the camp office, it meant that that was it, that this was their death sentence. So the Tzvi Hirsch Meisels understood that if he resisted, he'd be killed on the spot. And if he went along, so he'd have another 10 minutes to live. So he went. He gave his boots to one person, right, thinking that this is it. He gave his coat to another person, his food ration to a third person, and he went, said vidui, and was prepared to be shot. He walks into the commandant's office, and this Nazi looks at him and he says, "Rabbiner, sit down. Something's bothering me. I have a question. You're going to have to answer this question." Sits down, he says, "Rabbiner, tell me, doesn't it bother you that your God is permitting we Nazis to do such terrible things to you Jews? Don't you have questions on your God? You believe in this God. How come he's letting us do all these terrible things to you? Doesn't that bother you? Don't you have questions on God?" So Rabbi Meisel said to him the following. He said, "When I was a little boy in Cheder, our Rebbe told us we shouldn't ask a lot of questions on God because God will invite us up to answer the questions and we don't want to be invited up so fast. So we therefore shouldn't ask so many questions. And since I heard that, I don't ask too many questions on God because I really don't want to be invited up very quickly to get the answers." The Nazi laughed. He liked the answer. He let him go. He survived the war. Says Rav Shamshon Feuerherz, That is what God said to Moshe Rabbeinu. He told him, Hinei makom iti. From my perspective up here, where I can see everything, there's no questions. From your perspective down there, there are no answers. You want to get answers? Come up here and see it from my perspective. If you're not interested in doing that so fast, then have patience and have a little emunah and bitachon. And in the end, when you see the whole picture, you'll see that everything works out. That's why the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it says, well, we'll end with this idea, not end this year, but end this idea. The Gemara says the following. It says a pasuk we say all the time, every day. V'hoi Hashem l'melech al kol ha'aretz. Bayom ha'hu yiyeh Hashem echad u'shmo echad. On that day, God will be one and His name will be one. So the Gemara asks a very simple question. And now God is not one? Only then will He be one. Now He's not one? And only then will His name be one. And now His name is not one? What does it mean? Only then. Bayom ha'hu, then will God be one and His name be one. The Gemara says, yes. True. Lo ka olam hazeh olam haba. This world is not like the next world. In this world, on good things we say hatov ha'netiv, and on bad things we say adayin ha'emes. But in the next world, we'll only make hatov ha'netiv. Now let's first analyze what that means. If it means that in the next world there won't be, this world is good and bad. So on good we say hatov ha'netiv, and on bad we say adayin ha'emes. But in the next world, there's only good. So we'll only be making Atova Ametiv. It has nothing to do with the brachas. It has to do with the fact that this world isn't the same as the next world. In this world, there's good and bad. In the next world, there's only good. That's what it should have said. What does that do with the bracha? Says the Tzlach, one of the commentaries on that Gemara. He says what it means is the following. In this world, we saw things that looked to us good and looked to us bad. And we made the proper bracha. On the good, we made a bracha tova meitiv, and on the bad, we made a bracha dayin ha'emes. But in the next world, looking back at this world, we will see that those things that we made a dayin ha'emes on were really good. But we didn't see the whole picture. We didn't see how it fits into eternity, that really what appeared to us bad was really ultimately for the good. And therefore, in the next world, looking back on everything that happened in this world, we'll only make one bracha on everything. And that's the bracha of Atov HaMeitiv. That's what it means. In this world, in the short term, we see what appears to be bad. But ultimately, if we see the whole picture, we see eternity, all that which appeared to be bad really was for the good. That is, what's it called, that part. Then the Gemara says, so God, in this world, is not really one, because we see two different attributes of God. We see God as the judge and God as the merciful. We see the good and we see the bad. But only then will we see that everything unites under that goodness of God. And then, Ushmo Echad, God's name is one then, but not now. Why? It says, Lo ka olam hazeh olam haba. This world is not like the next world. In this world, we write God's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei. But we read it, Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. But in the next world, we write it and read it the same way. Yud Kei Vav Kei is written and read. Then we'll say God's name as it's written. Not like in this world where you don't say it as it's written. You read it differently than it's written. What's the meaning? I think the meaning perhaps could be the following. The name Yud Kei Vav Kei means Hoya Hove Yiyeh. God is eternal, but more than eternal. He transcends time. He was, is, always will be at the same time. God, by God, there is no such thing as time. God transcends time. He is, was, and will be all at the same time, because there is no time by God. That's the name Yud Kei Vav Kei. That name is a name of mercy. Is a name of mercy. In this world, we don't see that. We believe it. We write it. But we can't relate to it. How do we relate to God in this world? As Aleph Dalet Nun Yud. As God who is the master of the world in time. In creation. Connected to creation. Where there's a past and a present and a future. And we are limited by time. What is the name Aleph Dalet Nun Yud? Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, I think, has the following hint to it. The Aleph represents God at the beginning of creation, when he was one. There was nothing else. Aleph, just him. The Yud, in the end, represents the ultimate culmination of history, when everything will unite into one unity again. All the many things that God created will once again unite under him. That's the number 10. The number 1 is the simple unity. 10 is a unity of many things. In a decimal system, that's what 10 is. Up until 10, every integer is separate. Once you have 10 things, you have a unit of tens. And that's why in Arabic numerals, 10 is 1 10 and 0 1. It's a unit. That's why a minyan is 10 people, because it is a community. It is many people who now are unified into one unit of 10. In Hebrew, every number till 10 is a different number. Once you get to 10, you don't have a new number after that. You add on to the 10. Achadesre, Shtemesre, Shloshesre. The 10 remains a unit to itself. So the number 10 represents many things unified together and returning back to that one. 10 is 1 and 0. It's now a one of many things. So the world started with God before creation being the ultimate one, and its culmination will be, the end of history will be, when all those many things unite into 10. So the Aleph represents the beginning of time, and the Yud, the end of time. What is sandwiched between that Aleph and the Yud? Two letters. Dalet Nun. What's that? Din. There you can see judgment. There you can see bad. There you can make a bracha dayin ha'emes. Only sandwiched in time. But if we could be beyond time and see the whole picture, the yud kei vav kei, everything is only mercy. In the next world, we will relate to God as yud kei vav kei. We won't be limited by time. We'll see the whole picture. Everything will be mercy. In this world, we are limited by time. We don't see the whole picture, and therefore we see din. And that's what dayin ha'emes means. When you make the bracha dayin ha'emes, you're not saying that God is the true judge. That's, I think, how it's translated in most siddurim that have a translation. Dayan ha'emes, God is the true judge. But that would not be the proper way of expressing that. To say that God is the true judge, you would have to say Dayan ha'amiti, where amiti is the adjective that describes the judge. He is the true judge. Dayan ha'emes, I think, means something different completely. Dayan ha'emes means that God is the judge of truth. Dayan, he judges truth. There's only one truth. Ultimately, there's only one truth. How to get to that truth sometimes has to happen in a way that appears to us good, and sometimes in a way that appears to us bad. So we make the bracha that God is the judge of truth. He knows how to bring that truth. Sometimes it happens in a sweet way, sometimes in a bitter way. It's always for the good, but it always doesn't appear to us as good. Sometimes it appears to us as very tragic, bitter, but ultimately it's for the good. God judges the truth. There's only one truth. But God judges how it's necessary to bring it. Sometimes he has to bring that truth in a way that appears to us to be bad, temporarily, and sometimes he brings that truth in a way that appears to us to be good temporarily. He judges how to bring it. He is the judge of truth. And therefore, it says that when a person makes that bracha, dayin ha'emes, he should do it b'simcha. It doesn't mean he should be happy, right? When you make a bracha, rachmanu litzlan, people make a bracha at a cemetery, dayin ha'emes, they don't do it b'simcha. They don't do it happy, unless they didn't like the person who died, right? I once had a case where probably the people at that funeral made the bracha dayin ha'emes b'simcha, right? In Miami, I used to do funerals for people I didn't know, because the funeral chapels would call me and other Orthodox rabbis and say, we have somebody who was unaffiliated with any temple or whatever, they had no rabbi, they died, and the family requests an Orthodox rabbi. not because the people are Orthodox, because they want, you know, they want to make sure that the guy gets where he's going and that they do everything right. Everybody becomes frum when it's talking about death, so they want, you know, they don't want the conservative rabbi, they want a real Orthodox rabbi. Okay. Willing to do the funeral, and they used to pay for these funerals, so it had an incentive there also. So there's only one problem. Part of a funeral, perhaps the most important part, is a eulogy. And you have to say something about the person, right? And not only that, you have to say the truth. Because if you say lies about the person, right, if the neshama hears, and it's in the world of truth, it's very oppressive to the neshama to hear lies. Besides that, the neshama says, there's nothing good you could say about me that's true. You only have to make up lies. So it's not good for anybody to say lies at a eulogy, even though people many times do that. Right? I was met once at a funeral, and the person was giving the eulogy. The person was a nice person. The person was nifter, but a very simple, nice person. And the person giving the eulogy made this person sound like he was Moshe Rabbeinu. I mean, it was beyond belief, the things that he was saying. So I was standing behind the nifter's widow. And she turned to her friend and she said, I think I'm at the wrong funeral. That's not my husband. So in any case, that's not the kind of eulogy you're supposed to give. You're supposed to give a eulogy that's true. So, how do you give a true eulogy about somebody you never met? Right? At that time, it's very hard to get to know them also. So, I used to call the family or meet with the family before the funeral and tell them, could you tell me some nice things about the nifter? We're talking about people, again, were unaffiliated, weren't from. So, I wasn't going to say, well, they learned Torah well and they were really, you know, midaktik and mitzvahs. So, what do you say? They had a good sense of humor. They never spoke badly about people. They were hardworking people who supported their family and loved their family and whatever. And those are very good things. And I would have something, a piece of Torah or whatever that fit the parasha, that fit the thing. And that was the eulogy. Okay, just had to fill in the blanks. Right? So I met with this family. There was a wife, a few adult children, and a sister of this man who was nifter. And I said to them what I just told you, tell me some nice things about your father, your husband, your brother, that I can say a eulogy. And there's silence. For 5 minutes, they're sitting there, nobody says a word. Finally, they're all looking at each other, and they all look at the wife, and she nods her head. She stands up, she says, Rabbi, there is absolutely nothing good to say about my husband. And the sister and the children are all shaking their head, yeah, in agreement, right? I was like, I'm still going to look. Every time I say this story over, I say I'm going to look in my notebook to see what I said at that funeral. I don't remember. I do remember that after that funeral, I went home. And on the way home, I bought some little treats and little toys for my children. And I said to them, remember this. That was the only funeral I think I ever was at where the people said a dayin ha'emes b'simcha. It doesn't mean you're supposed to be happy. What it means is that when you're crying and you make that dayin ha'emes, you have an inner feeling of security and satisfaction that there's a purpose, that it's not in vain. There's a reason for this. And ultimately we'll understand why it was for the good. Right now it hurts, and right now you have to cry. But at the same time that I'm crying and that I'm making that bracha, I have a belief and a trust in God that the reason I'm crying and the reason I have to feel bad is ultimately for the good, that it's not in vain. There's a purpose to it. That's what it means. So therefore, having misunim badin, we learn from not climbing upstairs. Don't look at things as separate stairs. Look at it like a ramp. It's all one continuation. And if you can't see the end of the ramp, realize that if you're looking at what you're seeing right now, it's not the total picture. And don't make judgments unless you see the entire picture. You can't. Last night on the radio I heard that they were, the BBC, They were questioning the fact that today you can see history unfolding. Obama said that's what you see in Egypt. I don't know what he sees in Egypt, but in any case, Achen Veid is, you ought to get a pair of glasses. But in any case, history unfolding, and that's what happens. Here today, you see everything unfolding in front of your eyes, and everybody, all the newscasters already make pronouncements of what is before they see what's going to be the next minute. And you don't know what's going to be until you see the whole picture. It's much better to wait and hold your tongue until you see the whole picture, so before you give commentary and say what the meaning of this historical occurrence is. History it is, but what is good, bad, indifferent, how are you supposed to relate to it? Wait till you see the whole thing. We live in a world though where everybody sees things piecemeal, makes their declarations about it, and then it's hard to get those ideas out of your head once you got the distorted ideas and were pushed into your head before you saw the whole picture. So that's what it means, have a mesunim badin. Be like on a ramp. Understand that there's one continuum. It's not separate steps. If you look only at the separate steps, you're going to see things distorted.